Trying to produce high quality content as a business owner probably seems impossible right now with how busy you are. You probably have ideas, but you're burnt out and you just don't have the time, resources, or manpower to actually create ongoing high quality content. Freelancers are undependable, the employees you can afford are inexperienced, and agencies are way too expensive. So what's the solution? Breezy Content is a subscription that matches you with your very own content marketing team that will do everything from the strategy and planning of content to the writing, designing, and publishing of it. We handle everything from social media content to blog writing, SEO friendly content for your website, and even lead generation pieces. We have multiple research methodologies that we use, including interviews, questionnaires, and more, to make sure that all of the content that we create for you is custom, high quality, and will actually move the needle for your business. Don't believe me? I get it. See what our real customers are saying. If you're interested in learning more, book a call today. To learn how to create ongoing content when you don't have time to, visit makecontent.today for our free guide.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air. I feel like it's been forever since last week for some reason.
It's been a minute. I mean, it's been 7 days, but yeah, you're right. I think especially when we get into these months that are out of the summer months and into the months where work has really picked up in all markets globally, so much happens in a week. I don't know about you, but I can be in a mall on a Thursday and I'll be like, oh, I'm gonna save that one for the podcast on Wednesday. Then yeah. I'll be, you know, something will happen on a Saturday morning. I'll be like, must remember to raise that with Dan and the listeners.
And then you just forget everything when it actually becomes time to record. At least
don't speak for me.
Feeling.
I have a good memory and I have a good system with noting stuff down. Speak for yourself.
That's good. That's good. I've just been in so many places this week, which I think contributes to that feeling.
I can't keep up where you've been.
Yeah. The feeling of it's been forever since we recorded. And then yesterday on the phone, we were talking about how is it already October? I don't understand what is happening.
I know. It's, well, why did we speak? I mean, how did this come about? You and I were discussing the text message conversation we were having when I was flying over Russia to LA.
Yeah.
And I said to you, that was a year ago this week. And then we had that moment. And I know, you know, there are a lot of people that agree with this kind of sentiment that, what? It's already October? But there are just as many people that are like, shut up, it's October. You know, like,
yeah.
We get it. Yeah, we don't feel it's gone fast, but I feel it's gone increasingly, crazily, scarily fast.
Yeah, that and the fact that you were in LA over a year ago, which I cannot comprehend because LA was your identity for the first half of this podcast. And now it's been more than a year. Oh my God, that was almost 10 years ago, Alex.
Shut up. It was not. It was literally 5 minutes ago when I was just strolling along, you know, Rodeo Drive, and you were so shady and salty that trip. I think, guys, if any of you are recently, you know, part of the On Air family, if you have only just started listening over the last few weeks, go back to one of the episodes with either Avocado Toast or LA in its title from now a year ago, and just to hear Dan, just don't even worry about listening to me. People do enough of that. Just listen to Dan. That's quite something. In fact, I know what I'm doing later.
You know, that's still one of my favorite episodes. It might be very memorable to me because it was so early on, but us talking about like LA for 20 minutes and then we went into Trump calling the 757 that praying mantis and you doing that impression, like there was so much that was so enjoyable.
Well, what's funny
about
the whole, you know, us discussing Trump last year is that we felt like I don't know about you, but I felt like we were discussing someone who was barely relevant. You know, the odd crazy tweet popped up after months and months of silence. You know, little did we know, well, a lot of people knew, but little did it feel like that 1 year later now, he seems to be within a breath away of the presidency.
Yeah.
You know, pending, of course, a free and fair democratic election. Go to iwillvote.com to ensure you have a voting plan.
Thank you. Love that. Yeah, a year ago, he was calling the 757 a praying mantis, and now he's claiming that people are eating your cats and dogs. So times change. We want to talk about what we promised to talk about last week, which is my Virgin Atlantic experience 2 weeks ago now, or a little less than 2 weeks ago. Yeah. And Alex, you were getting the live version via text message as
I'm never
was
sure
going down.
If we're able to swear on the podcast. I know we swear a little bit, but I'm never sure if we're able to swear or if Spotify will remove the episode or slap us with a kind of explicit thing which will limit it. So I won't swear, but it's always I know, you know, just got real when Dan starts swearing in WhatsApps, in messages to me. I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be good. When, before I even ask, you know, what happened? If he's swearing, somebody's pushed him over the edge one too many times. And I believe that somebody is Richard Branson's Virgin Atlantic.
Well, honestly, I feel like it's not Virgin Atlantic. It's Heathrow. We know it's Heathrow because...
For you, yeah.
Yeah, for me. At the start of this year... I think even last year, but at the start of this year, we were talking a lot about gate A10, which was the beginning of our Heathrow trials and tribulations. Mm. Then in May and June, there were so many things that happened. My flight from London to Gothenburg got canceled. And if you remember, it ended up taking me like 12 hours to get from London to Sweden, including two planes. One or two trains and one bus. Then a few weeks later, my bags didn't make my 2 hour connection at Heathrow. And then 1 week after that, my flight was canceled again, but this time from London to New York. So that one was with Virgin Atlantic. Then I didn't go back to Heathrow. So life was fine. Everything was fine and dandy until I tried to go back to Heathrow again. And then go figure. I show up at Virgin Atlantic check-in. This is on the 18th of September, ready to fly upper class finally after my previous attempt in June failed. I checked the seat map. The flight is sold out, all 44 seats taken. We look good. We're in 10 and 11 alpha, where I like to be toward the back. And as I'm in the taxi on my way to Virgin Atlantic's upper class check-in, I'm checking flight radar, as I always do, and I see, oh, they've loaded the registration. That's great. So I go to track the history of that registration, and since I've been very intent on flying Virgin Atlantic for months and getting this review, I know exactly where they send their different configurations. So I'm like, that's weird. This configuration only goes to Delhi and Orlando. What's up with that? Those are usually leisure destinations where they send their high-density A350s. So I go on airfleets.net, I think it is, and look up this registration, and it says 16J, so 16 business class seats rather than 44. And I go, that's weird. It's probably just misloaded. You know, flight radar sometimes doesn't get it correct.
Yeah.
So I show up at check-in, and as I mentioned in my video...
I guess actually at this point, before we hear what happened, let's just give a little bit of context to what high density is, right? To the listeners that might not be aware of. So typically when an airline has, let's say a two or three class cabin configuration. So in Virgin's scenario, they have upper class, premium economy and economy. There are decisions that airlines can make based on where they deploy these aircraft that affect the configuration on specific aircraft when they know, for example, that if they have a destination, perhaps a secondary city in India that is always packed, sold out in economy, but there's weaker, you know, modest upper class demand, then knowing that, you know, assuming they have enough data to be able to demonstrate and prove this is going to be worthwhile, what some airlines do is on specific aircraft, they reduce the number of seats, so they're reducing the cabin size in terms of capacity in the premium cabin, such as upper class. So upper class in this scenario shrinks from a cabin of originally 44 to a cabin of just 16, and they replace the extra space with more either economy or premium economy seats, knowing that those cabins do better in that specific market. Now, this can get really complicated for airlines to manage, so they don't do it too often. And if they do it, it's usually just a handful of aircraft per fleet. Most major airlines have a handful of aircraft that have been adapted to a high density configuration, the likes of Emirates, the likes of Cathay Pacific, and now in Dan's scenario with Virgin Atlantic. So when Dan had spotted that registration, knowing it goes to the high density only routes, I guess for you, Dan, that's red flag number one.
Exactly. Thanks. Very good context there. And just to add the very satisfying detail here that they remove 28 upper class seats in this case, going from 44 to 16. They have the same number, a crazy 56 premium economy seats. So then the remaining extra seats are economy class. So they add exactly 100 economy class seats in place of 28 upper class seats. And to me, that's actually like less seats. Wait, what am I thinking? Like 28 upper class seats takes up a lot of space. So adding 100 economy class seats is like, okay, that's pretty good. But of course, given that they have so many more passengers, they also end up adding lavatories, which takes up more space and things like that. So the whole sort of internal configuration of that aircraft is different. But anyway, at this point, I still wasn't too worried. I figured there's no way they're sending this to New York. Our flight was sold out in upper class. It doesn't make any sense. And I went to check on Flight Radar, which aircraft Virgin has on the ground at Heathrow. And I'm like, oh, look, they have like four of their regular out of seven A350s with 44 business class seats. There's no way they're going to change ours, you know, so.
You think, of course, you're safe because, as you say, you are flying between London Heathrow and New York, which, again, for further context, is the only billion-dollar route in the world. It is the only route in the world to generate more than $1 billion in annual revenue. This is as premium as it gets. Exactly. I'm quite sure Virgin Atlantic could send an upper class only A350 and probably still sell it out on New York. Okay, admittedly not all the time, but you know when there is something happening in the great states. So yeah, it's not somewhere. I mean, you would think you'd get high density economy, right?
Exactly. And you think about 44 upper class seats. British Airways, United, there are airlines that fly upwards of 60 to 80 seats on one flight in business class on this route, just for context. So we get to the lovely upper class check-in wing. And obviously the guy checking us in was new because he printed our boarding pass and looked very confused when at the very top of it, there was in big bold text saying seat request. And I saw that and I immediately was like, oh no. Flight Radar was correct. So then I'm starting to wonder what's going to happen now. And
where did seat request show up?
At the very top of the boarding pass that he had printed, like a big kind of note with those stars you have on your phone keyboard.
Yeah.
On both sides. So I was like, oh boy. And he's trying to figure out what to do. There's one other colleague there checking people in who's busy. So he's like calling down and then he's like, oh, I think I need to go downstairs to the regular check-in to try to sort this out. So he leaves without much. He doesn't even explain what's going on, but obviously I understand and I'm explaining to Oscar. And we got there for once 3.5 hours before the flight because I wanted to try everything in the clubhouse. So luckily we had so much time. So then I go out, I record some videos saying, I think this is what's happened. I don't know if I texted you yet at that point. So after like 30 minutes, the guy still has not come back. So then one of his colleagues, because we're just sitting there, she comes up to us. She's like, can I help you? And we're like, yes, please. So she looks at our booking as well. And she goes, oh goodness, there's been an aircraft change. I'm like, well, we knew that, but your colleague who's been gone for 40 minutes at this point or who's been working on it for 40 minutes didn't bother telling us.
Right.
So she tries to sort everything out. And thankfully, she was great, super apologetic, and she was trying to find us some solution. And I think at this point, when she sort of told us the alternatives we had, which was either to rebook on a different flight, but there was no space the rest of the day on Virgin. So we might have had to fly the next day if I wanted to fly Virgin Atlantic, or take that flight, accept a downgrade. And as she said it, without disclosing any of the terms and conditions, she said, you'll both get a free round trip ticket in upper class as compensation. I went, okay, that's not bad. So that's when I text you, you will not believe that again at Heathrow, something is going wrong. What did you think when I texted you?
Well, firstly, I couldn't quite believe that that text was coming through, because it just seems that you can't fly from London Heathrow without it being some kind of big story. Secondly, I couldn't believe that Virgin Atlantic had put a high density economy aircraft on New York, of course, on your flight.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then, of course, the situation that it actually leads you in, serious speaking, you know, if you were not you and you know the ins and outs of the game and you're just a regular passenger and you're basically turning up to a check-in now to be told your seat doesn't exist anymore. So you have two options, either go tomorrow, and you're like, okay, well, that's not ideal. And I always feel sorry when passengers are given that option. I think, God, I hope they don't have a cruise or something like that, you know, yeah. Or a birthday, or only 3 days off of work or whatever. It's just not convenient for anyone.
Yeah.
And, or the option of accepting a downgrade, which is really shitty as well, because when you think that, you know, what are the circumstances for that trip? Had someone saved up all year? Was this the trip of a lifetime? Was this a honeymoon? Was this that trip, you know? And it just meets an aviation operational situation. Accepting the downgrade and then being offered, you will get two, but not you will get two, you were two traveling already, right? So you'll get one each, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you will each get a round trip upper class ticket. Now, just remind me, were you flying one way with Virgin Atlantic on this route?
Yeah, it was one way upper class. So
the attractiveness of that is, of course, they're offering you a round trip with Virgin in upper class. So it's, you know, a flight at a later date, but also the addition of a flight that you actually never had and wasn't ever affected.
Yeah, exactly. So they were offering, they said, we have two seats left out of 56 in premium economy, but they are two middle seats in a 2-4-2 layout. You would both be sitting in between random people in the middle of the cabin, like the third or fourth row. And I was like, you know what? Given that this aircraft has just added 100 economy class seats to this flight, which clearly will not be booked in the remaining 2.5 or whatever hours until the flight at this point, I will much rather sit in economy in the bulkhead row. And I think you agreed with me that that was the right decision.
I did. I mean, I said to you very, you know, the lawyer Alex kicked in and I said to you, but Dan, there's going to be conditions. I said, you must get it in paper. You must secure in writing where it's so easy for the check-in agent, as lovely and as sweet as you described her to be, to say, it's fine, pop it. We're going to give you two round trip.
That was literally her.
Virgin Atlantic upper class tickets. I'm like, that's great. Try calling the call center and telling them that if you have nothing in writing.
Yeah.
So I said to you, get it in paper. Secondly, I said to you, there is no way that's going to be without conditions. Maybe it's only a reward flight. Maybe it's only the lowest fare class, which will never be available unless you're booking from a year out on a route like New York or even LA or somewhere like that. So I said to you, just make sure that whatever you agree to, you get in writing. I did agree with you that taking the downgrade and having no other compensation by just going, well, actually, no, what would have the what would the compensation have been had you have accepted the middle seat premium?
So UK law mandates for any downgrade, you're supposed to get 75% on a long haul flight of your flight cost back for that leg. So keep in mind, if someone is flying round trip, it gets a bit complicated because let's say you paid $4,000 round trip. Well, then your one of those two legs is $2,000, and then you're getting 75% of that back. So in the end, you're still paying $2,500 for your ticket and you get $1,500 back. So in my eyes, also I was paying with points, but I think to a lot of people who are flying upper class, and this is the thing, when I said in my video, I feel so lucky that I haven't flown transatlantic economy in 7 years, but there's many people who are much more particular about how they fly than I or we are. So for them to get a downgrade, I just view a 75% discount as not even enough as the legal option. Because think about, like, to a lot of people, to be honest, telling them, okay, you're going to fly instead of upper class with a lie-flat seat, you need to fly, imagine economy was sold out, you need to go in a middle seat in economy on this flight instead. For a lot of people, they'd say, you couldn't even pay me to do that, and I'm still going to have to pay 25% of the original price I paid.
Well, that's the bit, isn't it? It's the realization. It's not that, oh, they couldn't pay them to fly in economy in a middle seat. It's knowing that they're still paying 25%, or they still will have had paid 25% of an upper class or premium economy fare. Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah, you're right. It gets really murky. And that's why I said to you, okay, if that package is genuine and they are offering you two round trip upper class tickets as that compensation, then go for it. And we both agreed, take an economy row, whereby we know that there was all those extra economy seats. It was the high density flight. Maybe you in the aisle seat or the window seat, Oscar in the aisle seat, and you have an empty middle. And I said, sure, you know, and you said to me, yeah, that's what you were already, of course, trying to sort out.
Yeah. Yeah. So the terms and conditions of that flight ended up being just like you said, it's subject to award space slash G class availability, which is the lowest fare. You also have to book it round trip. It's only valid to and from London. So you couldn't, for example, do Delhi to London to LA on one ticket. It's not valid for that. So there are a lot of terms and conditions, but anyway, we accepted that and we said we'd rather go in economy. We rebook into that. We still got to use the clubhouse, which is obviously one of the best, if not the best, business class lounge in Europe. Then our flight is delayed an hour, which was actually good because we got time to power up our devices. And finally, as the cherry on top, it wouldn't be an on-air episode without getting a bus gate at Heathrow. So obviously A10 does not exist.
Poor guy, you've been through it that day, haven't you? You had been through it.
Really, really. So A10 doesn't exist in Terminal 3, but they have gate 24 to make up for it, which I think we got 24D or something like that. So that was
I made a joke about 6 months ago that I'm now regretting. Okay, I think 6 months ago I challenged Heathrow and our friends at British Airways and other operators to, you know, I used to say hints, oh, he's coming to Heathrow, guys, you know what to do, that kind of thing. Yeah. Okay, guys, line Heathrow. Okay, line Heathrow. Give the guy a break. That's even coming from me, the co-host who roasts. Okay, he's been through it. He's suffered enough. Literally. Let the poor guy be able to take a point-to-point flight from the UK's hub airport without having to text me, Alex, WTF.
So true. It's crazy. The good, you know, again, I have to praise Virgin because their customer service is so good. And by the time I landed in New York, the email was already in my inbox with the voucher. And they also said, if you would prefer 100,000 points per person, we can give you that instead. So I was impressed by the variety of options offered. It was just like, again, are you serious?
Yeah. What about the follow-up since then? Have you heard anything from Virgin Atlantic, or do you know what you're going to do with these? I mean, what do you have? Do you have a PNR that you will use as the future tickets?
So I have a voucher number. They sent the voucher already and it said, Just call us within 36 months to book your ticket, or within 3 months of receiving this voucher, if you would prefer 100,000 points, just email us here with your voucher number and we'll send the points to your Flying Club account instead. So honestly, I don't think any airline would have or could have handled the downgrade situation better. Yeah. And I'm just so impressed. Then I was
it
back.
Sounds, and, go it ahead, sounds go like ahead. They did a good job. No, it sounds like they did a good job. And you know, specifically about Virgin Atlantic, again, I apologize. I think we may have told this story a while ago on the podcast, but do you remember what I told you about my voucher situation with them that stemmed from my auntie seeing their emergency landing on Sky News, right? so this was years ago, okay? I was a kid and there was a 747 emergency landing and it was the route that my auntie was booked to fly and she's already a nervous passenger. So she just watched this and she saw her flight number on the news, despite the fact her flight wasn't for a few months. And she emailed into Virgin Atlantic disgusted that they had suffered such a technical malfunction that led to this evacuation and this dramatic Sky News rolling coverage, whatever. And they replied, and she said, I want a refund now. And she's a lawyer, and she knew legally she wasn't really on any solid ground, because she had booked this, you know, the most restricted fare ever to Las Vegas from Gatwick. And Virgin replied to her saying, we're really sorry that you feel that way. We'd love to secure your business going forward. It wasn't up to our standards that we suffered this emergency landing and this trauma for the passengers and so on. Remember, she wasn't on it. Okay, this was something she just watched on the news. They sent her £1,000 in Virgin Atlantic vouchers that are like the physical vouchers in Virgin Atlantic notes of 100, right? And my auntie said, yeah, well, I'm not traveling anytime soon. So obviously I'm a twin. So she said to Demi and I, happy birthday. So she gave us Virgin Atlantic vouchers. We went to New York. But the funny part is, which I always remember, is having to redeem those vouchers back then. We booked over the phone. That's the only way you could do it. And we read out the individual voucher numbers for each. So all 10 of them. And then do you know what we had to do? We had to send the vouchers by post office.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Like signed special delivery for them to get to Virgin. And only then would the PNR be switched to a confirmed ticket from a provisional ticket. Well, that's really weird. Putting it into an envelope and they're saying in the UK... What's the value? Like £1,000. What is it? Airline tickets. What? You know, as if we're in the 80s again. And so just true. Sealing the envelope, and we're thinking, please, please, please arrive safely to Virgin Atlantic's, you know, global headquarters, where I'm sure mail is lost left, right, and center.
Yeah.
But it worked and we went.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I remember when you took that trip. That is our story for today about Virgin Atlantic. But speaking of Virgin, we have some other exciting news, right?
Yes, so this is making headlines everywhere, not least in Australia, home to many, many on-air listener. The headline is, of course, that Qatar Airways will take a 25% stake in Virgin Australia, which is one of the largest airlines, well, the second largest airline in Australia. This is a deal that is really set to shake up the Australian air travel market, because assuming it gets through the regulatory approval, which the expectation and indication suggests that it will, Qatar will hold this 25% stake in a competitor that is recently profitable, that is so currently financially sound, but also has this vision of assisting Qatar Airways expand its footprint in an increasingly protectionist market like Australia. So cast your minds back to the beginning of the year, where we know the Australian state declined the application of Qatar Airways and also a couple of others from increasing frequencies, flight frequencies, to several destinations, including the likes of Brisbane and Melbourne. How do Qatar get around this? Well, they are already close partners with Virgin Australia. That will now see them take a 25% stake in ownership. That's an equity investment in the airline that is owned by Bain Capital, which is a US company that acquired the airline back in 2020. Virgin Australia, currently, if we're looking at it, and for anyone that hasn't flown the airline yet, has around 100 aircraft. It employs little over 6,000 people, and they are the competitor to Qantas, which has increasing dominance in the Australian market, not least because Australia recently, Dan, lost the likes of Regional Express, better known as Rex, and also Bonza is a two... Bonza, what an Aussie name for an airline. But these are two carriers that are lost to the difficult and increasingly volatile market that is just entirely led by Qantas. They really have a sheer dominance there. And so what this will do is this will strengthen that competition. A Qatar-backed Virgin Australia is one that will ultimately be able to venture out a little further overseas, but also obtain capital and financial strength with the backing of Qatar, plus its recent profits, to be able to take on those horrifically high airfares that Australia have been battling with over the last 2 years. The market is often slated as unfair because of the way in which Qantas is able to rule fare prices and ultimately the cost of tickets. And so this is something that is set to hopefully be in the interest of consumers. Now, of course, there is a lot that Qatar has to gain as well.
Yeah, so what is in it for Qatar?
Well, we know that there have been a whole bunch of global equity investments over recent years. Qatar, of course, most people know as one of the world's best airlines, if not the world's best airline, but also in aviation business, its spread is far and wide. This is an airline that has a 10% stake in LATAM, the largest airline of South America, a 10% stake in Hong Kong's Cathay Pacific, a 5% in China Southern. Qatar is also the largest shareholder, the largest single shareholder in IAG, with a 25% stake in British Airways, Iberia, Vueling, Level, Aer Lingus, and so on. We discussed the recent 25% stake that Qatar is taking in Airlink in South Africa, again, another financially sound carrier. What is the plan with Australia? Well, you know, Dan, that Qatar has wanted to expand its presence in this increasingly protectionist market. And so by doing so with Virgin Australia, they take on Qantas domestically, they support Virgin Australia's ambitions internationally, and likely solidify their influence in a market where they want to operate. And we've already seen some of the announcements as to how Qatar is going to be able to be clever with this deal in adding flights to the Australian market. For example, recent reports suggest that they will have wet lease agreements with Virgin Australia, whereby Virgin Australia flights will be operated in a wet lease arrangement by Qatar Airways flights and cabin crew. Basically, a Qatar Airways flight sold by Virgin Australia. It's legal. It's playing by the rules. It's just being a little clever with it.
Yeah, I would love to see them be able to cut that crazy Doha-Melbourne-Adelaide flight that stays overnight in Melbourne, because sometimes I have viewers writing me who booked that flight and don't realize there's a stopover, because not all booking sites tell you that you'll be spending 5 hours in the dead of night when everything is closed, including lounges, at Melbourne Airport. But for context here, Qatar Airways has kind of found a loophole. We've spoken about this before, where they are able to add more flights to secondary cities in Australia. So although they want to serve Melbourne more than once daily, they can't do that officially. So instead, they sell that as a stopover on the way to Adelaide, but people can also end their journey in Melbourne. So what they do, they don't think anyone really wants to go to Adelaide on that flight, although there's always some people on each flight who do, is they land in Melbourne close to midnight. Then the aircraft stays there for 5 to 6 hours before continuing on. But everyone has to get off and wait in the terminal. So it's just an example of just inefficient lawmaking, forcing an airline to make such an irrational routing in order to be able to fulfill the demand that's there, the people, you know, and offer flights that people want to take. It's frustrating for sure.
It is. Well, let's move on. Speaking of frustrating, it's frustrating for a certain senator, I believe, in New York.
Not a senator, a mayor.
sorry. A mayor. Forgive me. I mean, I read this. Oh, of course. He's the New York mayor, Eric Adams, right? Yeah. Yes. I'm trying to find like a nice link into it. I'm thinking, wait, this is Eric Adams. Wow. Eric Adams has been through it. I mean, what is happening there? And isn't it funny how we always say there's an aviation angle to every single story, but this massive political story in the US is very much an aviation story.
Yeah. It's just so funny and ironic and bad on so many levels. So if you guys haven't been following this news, the New York mayor, Eric Adams, is being indicted at the moment, and he's facing corruption charges for many things, but a lot of them relate to travel and aviation. So that's where we come in, because part of what has been...
Hold on. That's where we come in on the podcast, not as part of the indictment.
Oh, no. Well, who knows?
We have nothing. Definitely well, not. Who knows? Well, speak for yourself, Dan. Is there something you'd like to declare on the episode today?
I said in my video
yesterday. Wait. You were... Hold on. Where were you just recently? Which city? Where were you at the time that Eric Adams' scandal broke?
At Eric Adams' apartment.
In New York.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
No. But...
You are the contact at Turkish Airlines.
Exactly. No, so what has been going on here is that since the mid-2010s, Eric Adams has been accepting free upgrades from Turkish Airlines. And this has been on many occasions, traveling as close to New York as Nice, France, which, you know, is not too crazy, or as far as China and other parts of the world. But every single time, he has chosen to fly Turkish Airlines because of the special treatment he gets. There are many...
Before you go on.
Yeah.
Are you saying he flies New York, Istanbul, Istanbul, Nice?
Yeah, just so that he can get his free business class upgrade.
God.
Yeah, so the thing here is that there's many things that are wrong with this, because I think initially, especially in some parts of the world, this is not really surprising behavior for politicians. And a lot of public figures get this type of preferential treatment. One of the problems of many is that Turkish Airlines is partly owned by the Turkish government, which means that it could potentially be viewed as foreign influence on a high-up official in the United States. Another problem is that he's required to financially disclose these benefits as a New York City employee, which he hasn't been. And then we'll get into the other illegal part of this as well in a second, but let's just give some context to what he's been doing. So, for example, I'm going to pull up some prices here of the types of bookings he's made, which to me, and I think to a lot of people in the frequent flyer or point space, is what makes this so bizarre. And we were discussing this a bit yesterday as well. So here's one. He says, Adams and his partner in October 2016 flew from New York to India for about $2,280. That's the price they paid for economy class, and then they accepted free business class upgrades.
Those are some expensive economy class tickets.
Exactly. Then, this one's a bit better. They traveled to Budapest in 2018. They purchased two economy class tickets for $560 each and then upgraded. But the thing is, $560 is a normal transatlantic business class ticket in off-peak season like this, January, February. That's not uncommon. But then he would contact whoever he knew at Turkish Airlines who was giving these benefits, some manager, and ask for a free upgrade. So what happened in a few cases is that toward the end of this, he just wanted to get his business class upgrade. He didn't care about the economy price. So the airline offered, okay, we'll just book you on this flight. And he said, no, I need to pay so that my credit card statements show that I've actually paid for this ticket. So they say, all right, we can charge you $50 if that's fine. He goes, no, you need to make up a realistic price I would be paying for my economy class ticket. So they go, what about $1,000? And he goes, okay, that's fine. So he ends up paying $1,000 for one of these tickets. So that's the other illegal part here, because he's being charged for, instructing people to create fake paper trails around his travel. And there's so much that's funny about this, isn't there? But the fact that it's Turkish Airlines business class that is corrupting him is just a bit out there.
What a strange thing to do, because, I mean, of course, unethical, potentially unlawful. We see all the valid points. Let's go to the aviation side of things. How many 777s in a 232 configuration did this guy fly on? You'd think, I don't know. It's just, was that really worth it? Turkish Airlines, on some of their aircraft, including that go to New York, I believe, right? The 777 still goes there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that business class is awful. Worth such a public indictment? I think not. It's just, what's your decision-making process when you're thinking about breaking the law, or you're thinking about acting unlawfully? You were placed there, you're in a position of power, democratically elected, there to represent the people, and then you risk it all for 232 in the forward cabin.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense in my head.
And the thing is, it's so unsmooth as well, because you're really gonna just, it's so selfish to accept these benefits only for himself and then still be paying like $1,000 or $2,000 when he could literally sign up for credit cards that read hundreds of blogs in the US, the country of credit card points, and redeem so for true. These flights for like $20 in business class instead of $1,000. Or he could have done, I joked about this in my video yesterday. Yeah. He could have literally bought my course and learned to fly in business class for less than he was paying for economy to then get illegal upgrades. But my point about the selfishness here is that at least if you're going to be a corrupt official, do something that helps the people. For example, tell Turkish Airlines, no, I want you to send your state-of-the-art A350s that you bought from Aeroflot or that Airbus gave you from Aeroflot with a beautiful business class suite with a door. Those are the only ones that are coming to New York from now on. We see this so often, even from the likes of Nigeria, of Ghana, that keep telling airlines to send their newer aircraft, and it works. But in this case,
well, it did. Well, one of those nations had to introduce legislation, didn't they, to ban, the Civil Aviation Authority banned aircraft over a certain age because they kept getting shortchanged by the likes of British Airways, who literally corporate planning British Airways were. What is the worst aircraft we have in our fleet? They were like, oh, it's the 30-year-old 777-200s that are Gatwick. Right, we're going to send them to this African nation. And understandably, they got fed up.
Yeah, but to be fair, it's a bit extreme because they did this with Delta as well, which has resulted in Delta having to send their newest A330-900neos with a beautiful business class there instead of the 767-300, which has an awful business class. But they send it everywhere. They send it all over Europe to the most London. Expensive. Yeah. So this, I can't remember if it was Nigeria or Ghana that was complaining about this situation specifically.
I think it was Ghana.
It's like, yeah, but it's like, it's not only you guys, you know, but they're using their leverage to say, we want a nicer plane, which unfortunately Eric Adams didn't do. He just accepted those 777s and was
all
happy
I hear
with
was
it.
Eric Adams was stupid enough not to sign up to your course.
Exactly. Because, points master.
He didn't even need to pay you as a, you know, employ you in his office or pay you as a freelancer. Just buy the course. And literally, then guess what? You're not on the front page of the New York Times, Washington Post, and CNN are not doing a wall-to-wall coverage about you and mentioning Eric Adam liked a window seat, you know, but that speaking of, it's just all too personal, you know, but it's his own fault.
Yeah. And the other kind of perfect irony about this is that what else is everyone talking about? Turkish Airlines business class. New York Times wrote a whole article about luxurious is Turkish Airlines business class.
Yeah, I saw it was how luxurious is the New York Times finds out.
And the crazy thing is that because Eric Adams was willing to corrupt himself and this whole thing leading to indictment just to fly Turkish Airlines business, everyone in New York is like, damn, that must be good. I need to book myself on Turkish Airlines business. So everyone is like, this luxurious state-of-the-art airline, instead of them being implicated in this corruption, it's somehow like they're being viewed as this incredible luxury because the mayor was willing to go to such an extent to be able to enjoy it.
You know what they could do if this all blows over and, you know, whatever the outcome is, and if he, you know, serves his whatever and blah, blah, blah. And you know how in 10 years people just forget. I mean, people forget after a year, but 10 years.
Yeah.
In 10 years, do you think we're going to see a Turkish Airlines advert where Eric Adams wakes up on an American Airlines flight and says, hi, I'm looking for the showers. Jennifer Aniston inspired, and there are no showers here, Mr. Mayor. Well, I'm going to look pretty silly dressed like this at the bar.
if Turkish Airlines was actually like a fun airline like Virgin Atlantic or something, they could make the best ads out of this situation. Just like Turkish Airlines, good enough to get indicted for.
It's like just so random. And that's why I had to clarify when the New York Times were explaining that he had flown from, you know, using it regularly to fly from New York to Nice. And I was thinking, wait, via Istanbul?
Yeah.
What? Is that a good use of anyone's time or money, let alone,
a public official? Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. Let's move into Q&A.
So Khalil tunes in and says, "Hey, Dan, another question for the podcast. I just flew from New York to Chicago on American Airlines in quote-unquote first class, which is the premium... Well, it's not real lie-flat first class on this leg. Anyway, as we were deplaning, the flight attendant dropped a potential bombshell. He asked us to close the window shades to, quote, help keep the aircraft cool. Is this the real reason window shades are always closed on U.S. carriers? Do you guys buy this, or is there another reason U.S. airlines hate natural light? Thank you so much." So I can answer this as the American on the podcast. You hear this all the time in the U.S. They even said this when I landed on my Virgin Atlantic Economy flight. In hot countries, they often just ask you to close the window shades. That has nothing to do with the reason that window shades are always closed in the U.S. I would say that is partly because airlines like Delta and JetBlue like to use their mood lighting and the cabin looks cooler when the window shades are closed. The other thing is that the majority of Americans, for some bizarre reason, which we've spoken about over and over again, prefer to have their window shades closed. And I just flew, I don't want to spoil it too much, but I just flew from New York to London on a U.S. airline. And from boarding, when every window shade was closed, to landing, I would say about 60 to 70% of the passengers did not open their window shade once to look outside.
I can't understand that.
The miracle of flight. And you're here keeping it closed the entire 7-hour flight.
Staring at your screen. Yeah, well, you've got your screen on the ground. You don't have a view from 38,000 feet while on the... Well, you know, we've spoken about that before. I would also add... Not only is it common practice there, but as you say, it is something that airlines routinely do here in the Middle East, but they don't tend to ask passengers. What they do is, you know, they let passengers be, do as you like. Then when they deplane, the staff quickly come in and lower all the window shades so that while the aircraft is on the ground, it doesn't, you know, they can reduce the amount it heats up, because cabin temperature is a real issue and operates the operational efficiency of airlines in this region at this time of year. Especially if you check Etihad, Emirates, Qatar, Saudia, there are often delays throughout the week that are noted down as, quote, awaiting cabin temperature to cool because the cabin got too high of a temp while it was on the ground. So it doesn't really affect the aircraft if they come in and it's a short turnaround, but if it spends the night on a remote stand, well, it's hot here, it's humid, it's dusty, it's, you know.
Oof. So here's another question from Ollie, and I like this because it goes back to Montreal. So he says, "Hi, Dan, absolutely love your podcast. It gets better every week." Thank you, Ollie. "Can you share your thoughts on these mobile lounges?" And then he sends a photo of... okay, let me just finish the question, then I'll describe it so we know what he's talking about. "I used it when arriving on BA at Washington Dulles and found it super lame and annoying after a long flight." So what he's talking about is these phenomenons that we have specifically at major airports, Washington Dulles and Montreal, where in Dulles, there's a satellite concourse that's not connected by train or walkway, but it's connected by these... They look almost like buses, but they go up and down like catering trucks. And
yes, the same thing. That's so funny. So, you know, Harnim, my friend.
Yeah.
So, Harnim just messaged me yesterday. He just landed in Washington, D.C. Oh. And he was like, "What the hell? They're transporting us off of the plane." He said to me, "In this sideways building."
Yeah.
That moves up and down.
Exactly. And have you seen those in Montreal? Because...
Yeah, they look... Yeah. So when I was taxiing out of Montreal a few weeks ago at night, suddenly I saw loads of these whizzing around. And I said, "What in the world is that?" It was these porter cabins that were, and they were doing speed, right? And there was, there weren't hundreds, but there were so many of them. And I was like, "What is this?
What are those?"
I thought, are they, I mean, my God, that flight had a lot of special assistance required, was my first thought. then I quickly gathered, wait, no, this is the way they're getting everyone off.
So the difference in how they're used, they're the exact same thing, but at Dulles, they connect to the terminal. So people step off into a terminal, but then they have to get on one of these to get to the main luggage claim immigration part. But in Montreal, they're used to connect straight to the aircraft. So there, people actually disembark into these. So it's more like a bus deboarding concept, except you walk straight into it. There's no stairs. And then you get delivered right into the terminal. So I kind of think in Montreal, it's a cool concept because it leads to almost no walking as a result. Because you're, you know, always when you're at a bus gate, at least the benefit of that, if anything, is that you get dropped off at the most central part of the terminal. And then with this, walking straight off and off the aircraft into one of those, being able to take a seat and then going straight to the terminal is very unique. But it's, Google those.
It was really funny. It was really funny to see. It's like a porter cabin at speed, full of people. Like, you know, it's funny because if it was on the ground, if it was ground level, that would just be a bus and it wouldn't be interesting at all. But because it's raised, it just looks funny.
Yeah, it just looks so strange. So
I have a question here before we wrap up. It's from, just get this gentleman's name. His name is, it's from Alex. He's in Doha. He says, hi,
Are
Alex
you sure
and
it's
Dan.
Not you?
He says, hi, Alex and Dan. I'm just wondering what the deal is with Dan's reluctance to upload that video of the flight you were both on in first class.
It is you.
He says, I've been waiting months and months with Dan's Dan's excuse of uploading in September now no longer valid given we are in October. I would like an explanation and I really love the podcast, especially you, Alex. Love, Alex and Doha. Thank you, Alex and Doha, for getting in touch. Dan, any thoughts?
Alex, I'm working on it. I'm sure... you will enjoy it once it's ready. It's coming soon. I just have to, I know we're really short on time, but I have to end with this because I love this question and it's such an interesting conversation topic that I think we can cover relatively fast. It's from David and he says, hi, Dan and Alex, longtime listeners of the podcast. Wanted to ask a question to both of you, referring to your conversation last week about Ben Smith's comments. If you don't know what we're talking about, tune into last week. While I don't agree with what he said, it makes me wonder whether European airlines are especially disadvantaged within the global market. I feel as though two of the largest cost drivers for airlines, fuel and staff salary, are higher in Europe than anywhere else. Conversely, though, high-paying jobs such as data scientists or managerial posts pay is better in non-European countries, leading to a talent drain. Furthermore, bureaucracy and climate-oriented policies also means expansion and modernization of airports cost more and there's no political will. Amsterdam with their shrinkage plans, for example. I think it's quite a long question, but as someone who, let's see, I needed to go down here. As someone who works for an airline in Europe, I feel like it's simply harder for airlines here to be anywhere near as good as Gulf or Southeast Asian carriers. Thanks and greetings. What do you think about this?
I think it's valid, but I think it's not entirely I disagree in that I believe that, yes, there are challenges that European airlines face that other airlines do in other markets do not face, not least, as you mentioned, the likes of high salaries on certain roles. And of course, unions pushing ever greater for increased salaries and more generous packages that put pilots, for example, on similar to what they earn in the US, and also what we're seeing in the likes of Canada right now play out with them using as the US as a justification. But I don't think that means that European airlines have it hard, because there are many, it just means they have different challenges. Not all airlines are in the same boat in the challenge that they face. And I say that because here's what European airlines don't face that other airlines have to navigate. Where it's easy to believe that, for example, the Gulf carriers have it easy, tell that to the Gulf carriers who are constantly having to navigate the complexities over conflict in the region. That's just what, you know, the geopolitical turmoil that happens across this region, and the way in which they have to remain agile and flexible and so on is something that, for example, Iberia would never have to think about. Is something that doesn't really affect Air France, of course, as war edges closer towards the East Mediterranean and also with Ukraine. It's something that is coming to fruition. But still, it's just different challenges for different markets. And that's why I disagree on it being a case closed. European airlines have it, you know, it's more tough. But yeah. But I just think it's different challenges. And how do we measure the severity of those challenges against each other? Then I think we're in a pretty level playing field when it comes to, you know, one has this challenge, one doesn't, but the other has that challenge and this doesn't. And so there isn't really a market where I can say they absolutely have a competitive market, apart from, as we mentioned, the likes of the Chinese carriers that are able to dump capacity and really lower their fares in order to climb out of the hole that they've been in since the pandemic. That plus, and I know you've got to go, quickly add, I checked, right, how much it is to get from here, Doha, to Chennai in India, okay? The cheapest option was with Etihad. Etihad are known for these next few months to be pricing out their competitors that even have their closest competitors looking, saying, what? Guess how much it was one way from me to go Doha, Abu Dhabi, Abu Dhabi, Chennai.
In business?
In economy.
I don't know, $100, $150?
$40. What? On two. And that was to fly this morning. I checked that yesterday.
Oh,
so
wow.
On a day prior, $40 on two full service Gulf carrier flights. That isn't, that's not representative of what is going on here in the Gulf at all. I'm just zooming in on how that has the other Gulf carriers like Emirates looking at their neighbor saying, what are you doing? But it's as many airlines kind of, you know, navigate the complexities of where we are in the world right now.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's a whole nother discussion about Etihad's specific role in the market. I just want to add quickly to what you said. I think you made a great point. Also, we should, you know, mention that, for example, Singapore Airlines exists in a geographic context besides Singapore with much less spending power than, for example, European or American airlines, which you could view as an event or a disadvantage. In addition, think about where are the most profitable airlines in the world. They are in Europe and they're in the US, especially in the US. So that argument, given that the US pays their cabin crew and pilots the most in the entire world,
I don't think... And pays their CEOs multiple millions.
That I don't think that argument really works. Another point to disprove that is that there are airlines in Europe especially that are better than many airlines in Southeast or East Asia or the Middle East these days.
Yeah.
There are also, for example, JetBlue Mint in the US is better than, in my opinion, some Middle Eastern airlines also. So it's just that we tend to attribute the biggest and the best to Emirates, Qatar Airways.
We see wealth and we think, oh, that means they're making all the money. But hold on, all the American carriers are making more money.
Exactly.
And they're paying their staff more and they're paying their CEOs more. And it's if they are able to be in a position where they're paying CEOs $30 million a year, just one man's salary, then I think we quickly realize, wait, things must be going great over there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what are the challenges that they face? Because if you're so, yeah, that's why we can't just clean slate answer that.
Yeah. Well, great question anyway. And it's been
really
great.
Good question. Yeah. Really good question. Yeah.
It's been great spending this time with you, Alex. Great joining you all as always. And we cannot wait to see you next week on air. Bye bye.
See you later.